This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, here we are. Think Tank Thanksgiving show. A little bit of twist on giving. We have two guests with us today. John Hall is involved in something called social enterprise. He's going to talk to us and tell us a little bit about what that is and what he's doing. And the second guest is Jerry Lewis, who is... Whoa, did I lose something here?
Well, there you go. You got to stop putting your folder on the mic slides.
Yeah. Jerry Lewis is the principal of Children's First Academy, and he will join us halfway or so through the show. And first of all, John Hall, tell us, what is social enterprise?
Well, first of all, Mike, thank you very much for having me on today, and I greatly appreciate your and KTR's support for nonprofits. Social enterprise, broadly speaking, can be a business enterprise that has a social mission. In our case, we have a more narrow component of that in that we provide both a social mission, but as well as we're focusing on providing where the majority of the employees are from underserved population groups. That can be homeless, ex-offenders, substance abusers, adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or, say, transitioning vets.
So, and your background is mainline for-profit business, is that correct?
Absolutely. I'm taking sort of an entrepreneurial approach to the nonprofit sector. I've worked in the venture capital industry with, say, Security Pacific Venture Capital Group, as well as the last 15 years, I've helped found a company that develops new products in the consumer product and the health wellness space. So, I've partnered with a number of other business leaders, community leaders, and entrepreneurs in helping develop this program.
So this your background, point of this is your background's just a little bit different from many people involved in social service agencies. It's a business background.
Yes, that's true. But for nonprofit social enterprise, it is important to have a blend of people with strong business backgrounds and then people with very strong human service backgrounds as
so,
well.
So how's social enterprise different from a traditional charity?
Well, one of the good news is it's less dependent on federal and state funding. The more successful social enterprise programs are able to scale, they're economically self-sustaining in that they typically have less than 10% of their funding come from federal and state combined. And so if there's a downturn in the economy, they can actually grow in economic downturns because they expand their business enterprise and generate from their revenues from within.
So you're doing things that actually make money.
Well, let's say break even.
Okay. You know, you have revenue that you generate from things other than donations.
Absolutely. The number one source of funding is the revenues that you generate.
Well, okay. Let's move from the general to the specific. The organization that you founded or working with now is called Quinsea. You can spell that and then tell us what it is.
That's Q-U-I-N-C-E-A. So it's we call it Quinsea Social Enterprise. And it's an organization where we're empowering and creating sustainable programs for developmentally disabled adults and for transitioning veterans. And in that context, our business enterprises will have the majority of our employees be from our underserved population groups. And so we'll be providing both job training and employment for our clientele.
So what do you actually have them do? What's the enterprise? That's the served groups. What's the enterprise?
Well, there's sort of three sectors that we have groups. The first being agricultural businesses. And so we'll have community gardens and we'll have greenhouses. Say the greenhouses will have things like hydroponics, aquaculture, aquaponics. The second sector is...
Say that again and tell me what that is.
Okay.
I'm from Long Beach. I know what that is. I kid.
Aquaculture is... where you're growing fish, typically tilapia fish in tanks.
Fish, I understand.
Hydroponics is where the micronutrients to the plants are typically from a drip irrigation system. Hydroponics very commonly is that's a non-soil-based hydroponic system. And then aquaponics sort of combines the two where you have waste from the aquaculture goes into tanks where you're growing the vegetables from the wastewater. And so it's a very and one of the things that's nice about those systems is they use less than 5% of the water that traditional soil-based farming does.
So these are outside of the box skills here. This you're not teaching somebody skills on how to mop a floor or how to show up to work on that. This is some really cool stuff.
Absolutely, but what we've done is we've taken top experts in the field. Like we spent a lot of time at University of Arizona's Controlled Environmental Agricultural Program as well as Cornell and Rutgers program. We've identified a number of top experts that are part of our staff, like Paris Masek's one, who's had 15 years experience in this. And then we've researched other social enterprise programs in other parts of the country. In fact, we've looked at 90 different programs, that nonprofit programs that have greenhouses, and looked at how can we take what they're doing in other locations and then scale that in Arizona. And particularly for our target group, as an example, say Finger Lakes Fresh is a very successful social enterprise program in Ithaca, New York, where they provide hydroponic lettuce for the high-end restaurants and grocery stores throughout that metro area. And 85% of their workforce is developmentally disabled. And so we're trying to build off best practices in other states and bring that into Arizona.
So give us a sense of what the end product here looks like. You talked, I believe, not here, but elsewhere about the idea of tying this to restaurants or food service for schools.
Absolutely. In fact, let's call it somewhat of a closed loop system. As example, is we'll be a local food producer and we'll be providing food for restaurants and schools. And at the same time, we'll take food waste from those sources. And the food waste will be combined with our other green waste products to create composting. And then, of course, the composting will be used as part of our agricultural system. And so with that, we have sort of a motto where waste for one is food for the next.
Sounds very green.
Well, we want to be both environmentally and economically self-sustaining.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Thanksgiving edition of The Think Tank right here on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're talking here with John Hall about social enterprise and his organization, Quinsea. I wonder if you can flesh this out a little bit for us. I have an image of there's some agriculture going on. There's some fish farming. There's maybe feed into cafeteria food restaurants and the like. Where are you in this process? And paint a picture of me what this looks like, where you are, what kinds of people are involved, who your partners are.
Sure. Well, we're just getting started, and we'll use a combination of both the business enterprises and then your traditional vocational training programs. So we'll have classroom settings where we provide life skills and other job development training.
And who's in these voc ed programs?
In the phase one, we're focusing on adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, mm-hmm. Such as autism, persons on the autism spectrum disorders.
Mm-hmm. And then veterans are part of your profile long term.
Absolutely.
Too, right?
Phase two will be veterans transitioning from the Iraq-Afghanistan war. And in that case, we're in particular, we want to target some of the veterans that have say a lower level of education, and so that we'll create a 20-hour work week with our social enterprises and allow them to go half time to three-quarter time in schools. And so we've created partnerships there with the community colleges, ASU, and other educational institutions in town. The business ventures will have part of them is to be really creative. Like one of our mantras is to take cost centers and turn them into profit center. So a traditional cost center to agriculture is transportation. And so what we've done is partnered with some car dealerships and whatnot, and the majority of our clients are not able to drive. So we use the same vans that we pick up and drop off our clients at the beginning and the end of the day, and we've created a delivery business. And so we are not only be delivering our own food products to sources, we're partnering with the Arizona Community Farmers Markets, and we'll be doing deliveries over time, be a cost-effective deliverer from regional farms, doing local foods to the same farmers markets and to schools and other sources.
So where is this process right now in the course of you're putting this together right now?
Absolutely. It's taken us a little over a year to go through the regulatory process with the Arizona Department of Developmental Disabilities.
That's because you're working with people who are on various kinds of state funding and state
absolutely.
Aid.
And there should be good checks and balances, and we've passed that all with flying colors. Our entire staff is very, very experienced. They have over a decade of experience with these target population groups, and we've been able to take not only experienced staff, but staff that have a real entrepreneurial bent, and that we're trying to bring in the private sector entrepreneurism and business approaches to helping create employment and to meet specific business needs.
Now, one of the things I found intriguing, having read through your materials, is that you see what you're doing as being scalable. You want to explain
that? Absolutely.
What that
meant? In fact, that's one of the core elements. We have a long-term goal to create at least 1,000 jobs within a decade for our target population groups. And one of the aspects is to obviously creating economically self-sustaining businesses, it's easier to scale. But
scale means you develop the model, you get it to work, you could truck this down to Tucson or elsewhere in the valley.
Absolutely.
And where are you right now?
We're in North Phoenix. Our specific address is 2701 West Grovers Avenue in Phoenix. We are looking at expansion plans in the West Valley as well as the East Valley. And then as we build our base in Metro Phoenix, we're definitely going to expand to other parts of the state. We've had a number of meetings in Tucson. They're very, very excited with what we're doing. And then we've even had approaches from the Navajo Reservation. And so we've been doing some planning, early planning stages up in the Navajo Nation as well.
Yeah, early stage, it had some involvement with SRP as well.
Correct.
Plot of land that they had.
SRP, as well as a number of other corporate partners, have had very strong interest. In fact, we had gotten approval for a 50-acre development in Tempe.
What are your biggest needs? How could just the average listener get involved, the average Joe around? Because it sounds like a great program, and obviously we're a pretty tight-knit community. We like to help. How do we help?
Well, there's three sectors. Well, thank you. One is financial donations, particularly in the early stages, we have startup costs. So as example, when I mentioned about the vans that we're using for both transportation and delivery services, there are costs to acquire the vans, as well as we have computers, other equipment, say farm equipment, et cetera, that we need some capital item support. The second sector is donation of items such as computers or say furniture for our vocational training areas. And then the third area we're looking for is volunteers. One of the parts, in fact, that impressed us with the more successful social enterprises, they were a magnet for volunteers, where it's sort of the village raising a child. In this case, the community came together. In fact, I was even impressed when I visited a lot of the other farms that had persons with developmental disabilities. I sort of thought of those farms as competing with other farmers. And it was just the opposite. The farmers came from all over to help support those farms because they very much believed in those social mission.
That kind of work seems to a non-expert like it could have a therapeutic side to it as well.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I've put a lot of emphasis on the economics. There is a huge impact on the health outcomes, mental, social, and physical health outcomes. And in fact, the surveys are very, very impressive. And when you think about that, you're taking a person, we call it converting a care receiver into a caregiver. There's a person that's somewhat dependent, and turning them into where plants and animals and others are dependent on them. In fact, example of one, we visited a farm in north, 40 miles north of Toronto, Blooming Acres. And their clientele that came in were low-functioning autistic persons, and many of them very depressed, average, say, 10 to 12 hours of TV a day, very sedentary. And after 6-9 months working in the farm, they had lost weight. They were sleeping through the night. There was just enormous changes.
We're coming up on a hard break. I wanted you to give you an opportunity to tell people how they can get in contact with you.
You can get a hold of me. Well, first of all, our website is quinceia.org.
You better spell that.
quinceia.org. You can reach me by email at jhall, at quinceia.org, or you can call me on my cell phone at 602-469-1460.
You're doing great work. Thank you very much. This is the Thanksgiving edition of the Think Tank right here on KTA. Coming up next, Jerry Lewis. And I got to tell you, we've had him in before. I'm excited about his program. I'm excited for you to hear about it. It will restore a lot of your faith in humanity. It's coming up next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back. Now, Jerry Lewis, old-time friend of the Think Tank. He is principal of Children's First Academy, which is the successor of what used to be called the Pappas School for Homeless Kids. There are two schools, one in Phoenix, one in Tempe. And I want to help us understand, and I also know you're a CPA by training, so I want to know a little bit where your money comes from and how is that different from a traditional school. I want to get into the fact that you are a charter school. I want to explain that, what makes that different, and how that differs from a traditional school. But you are a public school, that is correct?
Yes, charter schools are public schools. They are funded from your tax dollars, as is any.
But schools come. The money comes from multiple piles. Where's your what piles do you take from?
Our piles come from the general fund.
State of Arizona.
State of Arizona. You bet.
You have no access to local property tax?
We do not have any access to property taxes.
Overrides nothing. Bonds nothing.
No.
So what you get is what? How much does the state give you per capita?
Yes, per capita. It's around $6,000 per student.
Okay, and how does that differ from what? A traditional, say, by kid in the Tempe public schools gets?
Well, it's somewhat nuanced in that.
From multiple piles.
It comes from multiple piles. Their transportation is typically paid for. Their buildings are typically paid for. The charter schools receive X amount of dollars for their students, and mm-hmm. that is all they get from the state. That has mm-hmm. to be used to educate, transport, feed, do everything mm-hmm. else that other programs in the public schools and the district schools are having paid for them through other piles of funds.
So your funding is in a way simpler. It comes from one place and that's what you get, and it's around, you said, 6,000?
Around 6,000, yeah.
How does that compare to what?
It depends on who you're talking to on what day.
Sure.
Some people say it's around $9,000 when you add up the transportation mm-hmm. costs, facilities costs, and the per capita per student funding. It's around $9,000. So depending on which side you're talking to, the charter organizations, of course, say, hey, we're way underfunded. The mm-hmm. districts say, no, you guys are getting more than we are. But you got to compare apples to apples and realize that transportation.
And that's hard
facilities.
To do when you're, I mean, it sounds like yours is cleaner and easier to specify.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you get one pot of money and you got to make it work.
Now, you are a public school, but you are a charter school. What does that mean?
Well, a charter school, it's an opportunity for individuals to create educational opportunities for students with specific needs or wants of the parents or the students. And so what, about 20% of the population of Arizona now, Arizona students, are in charter schools, largely because parents want to have some choice in the schools they attend and the type of curriculum that is delivered and the type of programs that are delivered as well. So that every student that goes to charter schools typically is there because the parents have made a choice that I want them in this program over my neighborhood district school because of something that they offer.
Now, administratively, it's my understanding with charter schools, there's some rules that get relaxed, that you don't have to abide by some of the rules that apply to non-charter public schools.
It used to be somewhat so, but as charter schools have evolved since 1996 in the state, those requirements have not stayed the same. We're pretty much doing everything that the district schools are doing now in terms of reporting and regulations and so forth. We have to we do the state mandated testing. We have to do all of the other federal and state requirements that that most schools do.
Can we back up a second here? Because I think I'm speak for everybody when I say, wait, homeless kids. I'm not seeing a lot of homeless kids running around the valley. I mean, homeless kids, is this a big issue here in Phoenix? Or do we have a large homeless population of kids under 18 years old?
We actually do. In fact, some of the studies will show you as many as 30,000 kids. Some are around 18,000 to 30,000 kids are homeless. Wow. And you have to understand the definition of homelessness in legal terms. According to the McKinney-Vento Act, there's a certain criteria. If they're living in a home with more than one family, okay, if they're living with someone other than their parents, if they're transient in nature, they're moving around quite a bit.
They have a roof over their head, but it may not be the same roof every night.
Same roof every night, or it may not be with their own parents, or they may be teaming up with another family or two or three under the same roof.
Okay, so that suggests to me that you're dealing with a population that's going to have needs that are different and exceed those of a traditional school.
Typically so. Now, not to say that traditional schools don't have homeless kids in them. I think every traditional school will have a percentage of kids that fit the definition of homelessness. However, our particular schools, we cater to that population. We recruit that population.
How do you find them?
They find us, typically.
The referral, generally?
Yeah. There's a lot of talk amongst people, and we do some advertising, okay, through flyers and so forth. But a lot of it is word of mouth from friend to friend, and they actually find us.
Social service agencies?
We do have social service agencies. Some of the homeless shelters will actually refer to us. Sojourner, UMOM, Salvation Army have all been referrals to us.
Do you have trouble getting kids to show up for school? I would think if your living situation is unclear or varied, that just showing up for school every day might be an effort.
And you figure our attendance rates are increasing. They're improving because we go out and we transport these kids. We'll go out sometimes 10, 15 miles from the school to bring them in. But this is a huge problem with homelessness, is most kids are going to attend maybe 80% of the time, if that. Okay, so if they're missing an average of one day a week, they're not getting the education they need. And accordingly, their scores are going to be significantly less than those who are attending on a regular basis.
And you're going to get classified as a failing school.
And it becomes a downward spiral.
So what I want to move the discussion, my pet peeve, this tax credit thing. This is you want to explain what that is?
The extracurricular activity, also known as ECA tax credit, is a program by in the Department of Revenue where an individual can make a contribution to a school that the school will use for an extracurricular activity. Okay, consult your tax advisors, but typically if you pay
Arizona
you're
a tax
taxes,
advisor, you can.
There you go. $200 maximum tax credit for a single filer, and for a married couple filing jointly, a $400 tax credit for amount. So in other words, dollar for dollar, you put into this, you'll get that back, assuming you have Arizona tax liability.
It's not a deduction. It's a tax credit.
It's a tax credit.
Right.
And herein is my problem. I looked into, there's a state website. I looked into, this is $50 million statewide. It's not chump change on a statewide level. Scottsdale School District, $3 million. Paradise Valley, $2 million. How much does your district get?
Our district is all across the state of Arizona, which includes these two Children First Academies, around $100,000 altogether.
Okay, so the net of this program is this is, and who is it that is obviously going to make a tax credit donation is somebody who has a tax liability, and you also have to have $200 or $400 in your pocket right now. Even though it doesn't cost you anything, you have to write a check, even though it gets dollar for dollar reduced, you have to be paying taxes.
Exactly.
And you have to have the money in your pocket. Guess who that is? They're the residents of Scottsdale and Paradise Valley and some other places.
There's not too many of our students' parents who pay taxes.
So the net effect of this program sounds good. You can donate and your school gets this. But if you're in Scottsdale, and I looked at where most of it goes to sports, bands, things like that.
Well, it's a great way for you to fund a special activity of your child and not have it cost you anything.
Yeah, maybe
a little bit of
time. As
timing.
A parent, I've seen these things where you can either pay for this or you can write us a tax credit check that costs you nothing. And in effect, it is the poor subsidizing the upper middle class.
In many ways, yes.
The net of it. Uh-huh. So as I've noted, and we've done this before, this is, I think, an inherent inequity. There's one thing an individual listener can, however, do to rectify that to some extent. Take that tax credit and give it to a needy school.
Absolutely. And since our parents aren't typically going to be in that position, we rely on the outside world to make a contribution to the extracurricular activity tax credit and donate that to our school.
How, if they want to give it to Children's First, given that you serve a homeless population, how do they do that?
Just go online to cfaphoenix.org or cfatempe.org, and on the donate button, they can make an extracurricular activity anytime between now and December 31st. That will be a tax credit for them if they pay Arizona taxes in the 2016 tax year.
Okay, we will be back. We'll open up the discussion. John will be back with us, and we will talk social enterprise in the context of our schools. In the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, we're back with John Hall and Jerry Lewis talking about our schools, talking about social enterprise. John, there's been some synergy between social enterprise and our schools. You want to talk
Sure.
about that a little bit?
Well, I'll give two different examples. One is we've been working with some local schools in creating some early stage social enterprise programs with the special ed population. And so, like, for example, we've got some school districts interested in our creating social enterprise on their campus where we'll have both agricultural and some green waste components done on their campus, but we'll be mixing special ed students with special ed with adults with developmental disabilities, as well as other community members creating jobs on campus, as well as we've had a number of meetings with Jerry's organization. And in fact, I'm pleased that there's a group of students, Philip Glasscock in particular, is taking a lead on it, developing a social enterprise program on his campus with some greenhouses and eventually hoping to create a social enterprise library at the campus.
The nice thing about these programs, especially for the special ed students, is it gives relevance to everything we're teaching in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Most kids would prefer not to be in school. They'd rather be outside or playing video
hands-on,
games.
Hands-on, something that's hands-on.
This is hands-on, and when we talk about addition and subtraction, we can talk about, well, how many seats do you need to fill this row? It's X long, and you have this many seeds. They have to be so far apart. Can you please tell us practical problems that they need to solve in order to make this a success? And they get it. There's relevance, and we have some wonderful programs that have come in, including John's connections here, the Glasscocks. Just recently, we had Walden University put in some gardens at our Phoenix campus, some raised gardens.
In fact, that is the impetus for how I got you guys in here together when you gave me a tour of your school, and we walked out the door, and I saw these basically the beginning of a greenhouse without the top. I saw some beginning gardens there, and I said, I just sort of connected the dots to some of the stuff that I knew John was doing, and I said, well, you know, there's a common thread here.
It's the perfect marriage. You do something that kids like. They may not know they like it until they get out and do it. Gardening, maybe seem like a chore to a lot of kids until they get out and do it and they realize this is fun.
It's hands-on.
It's hands-on, and now they can equate that to what they're learning. You can create lesson plans around that garden, history, math, science.
Even seen presentations on learning styles that some of us are auditory, some of us are visual. And then there's the kinesthetic, those are people who learn by actual physical movement, and that enables them to process things in different way.
In our population especially, a lot of our kids are kinesthetic learners, and they have to be involved. Otherwise, they're going to be in trouble.
But by the way, I wanted to take this opportunity to do a little shout out. When you gave me the tour of your school, one of the folks in there, John Huppenthal, is volunteering in your school.
Yeah.
Now, John took a lot of flack for some issues, and I think deservedly so. But let's give credit where it's due. This is something that's being done quietly and privately, and
he'd probably blush if he knew we were talking about him. And if he's listening, shout out to John.
But a shout out is deserved.
He started with us last year on a sporadic basis, working with some of our high school students in math. So many of our students are so far behind in math; they may be in 9th or 10th grade, but they have a 3rd grade math level. And so this year here, he started with us with our 6th graders. Mm-hmm. This is where we feel we can catch a lot of the kids that come in deficient, and he spends a good 3 or 4 hours a day, sometimes all day, doing math problems with the kids. And a lot of it is very fundamental. You have a 6th grader that can't add 5 plus 5 or can't multiply 2 times 5. And so he's working with them on automaticity and recognition so that they can do the higher order thinking skills of math. Mm-hmm. Without this knowledge of how to do some of the basic math, they would be totally lost, and they are, and their test scores show. So it's a great thing that John is doing for us. Is so dedicated and great to have him on board. He's a brilliant man.
I've ruminated on that image when I saw him in there, and I said, you know, this guy was superintendent of public instruction for state of Arizona. I wonder, given this experience, if there are things that he would see differently now.
I'd like to ask him that. It'd be great to have him on the show.
Yeah, I thought that might be a worthwhile idea.
Yeah.
So you take on volunteers. Do you have a need in that area? And if so, what kinds of folks can you use, and what kind of commitment is required?
Okay, we always have a need of volunteers, and those volunteers can range from a number of areas, including helping in the clothing and food room.
Let's talk about what that is. That was an eye-opener.
You bet.
We have a
clothing and a food room where students and their families can come and pick up clothes that they may need, shoes, socks, underwear, hygiene equipment, as well as food. Sometimes
donations in those areas as
well? We take donations all the time, you bet. Mm-hmm. And just this week, I've had two groups that have done food drives for us. And by the end of this week, we'll be stocking our shelves again. Christmas time and Thanksgiving time are usually good times of donations for that.
Yeah, my sense of it, there's a lot of organizations that are almost overstaffed for Thanksgiving. Everybody wants to donate their time and whatever on Thanksgiving, and it's the other 364 days a year. Tough.
You bet. But the room is available for all of our students and their families to come in as they need it. Mm-hmm. And our approach to it is we want them to feel a feeling of abundance. If we don't have it, we'll get it. And we try to give it away as soon as we get it so that we can rely on the community to continue to replenish those sources, and those people can get what they need when they need it. But you can help in the donation room. There's maintenance inside, outside. There's painting. But then what we really need is like retired teachers or people that know how to work with kids. They have to get a fingerprint clearance card. That's the only requirement that they have, and the background check with DPS. But they can come in on a consistent basis.
Maybe John Huppenthal have to get fingerprinted?
John had to get fingerprinted. Oh, yeah. He did. In fact, he actually became highly qualified to teach math to do this as well. It's amazing. I mean, he's an engineer, of course, understood it all. But there's still a process he had to go through, like every other teacher, to
how do you translate that into the classroom? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So if we have people that are willing to give up an hour, two, three a week, maybe it's not every day. Maybe it's just an hour or two a day, once a week. We need more bodies. We have proven that we can overcome the poverty gap, the achievement gap, if we can throw enough people with the skills necessary to work with kids, isolate kids one-on-one, one-on-five, and give those students a chance to learn one-on-one, one-on-five, things that they're not going to learn in a group setting. And with this scarce resources that we have in the state of Arizona with our education funding right now. We can't get that from our regular funding. We rely on a lot of volunteers to do that. So if you have any listeners out there that are retired teachers or would like to do that, go to cfaphoenix.org or call me at 480-861-6931. We would love to have them volunteer. We need them.
Good. You anticipated my question. What about you, John? Can you use volunteers at this point?
Absolutely. We're definitely... have volunteers both in the classroom training parts as well as the business enterprises. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a big buddy system. An example of that is we've created a partnership with Young Life, in that Young Life typically they have a big buddies program for special needs students, but they age out at age 23. And so what we're trying to do is create a continuity program with special ed students that age out of a lot of services at age 21 and 23, and then move them into pairing with mentors and sort of adult big buddy partners that can help them with both on the business side as well as life skills in other areas.
And again, you can get to repeat if somebody, because we did that in the context of a donation. If somebody wanted to reach you, how do they best reach you?
They can reach me by going onto our website, quincea.org, quincea.org. In fact, even on we also have a donation button on our website as well. And then they can reach me by phone at 602-469-1460. Or email at jhall@quincea.org.
Okay, thank you, John Hall, Jerry Lewis. If you want to listen, this is a special Thanksgiving show for the Think Tank. If you want to listen to any prior shows, they are all now archived and up to date at mikeoneal.org. There's a button at the top that says radio. All the shows are there. And we will leave you with my favorite song because I wrote it.